everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM, a program meant to bring you better understandings of the things psychological. Psychological. As if logical of the psyche is what we're really talking about. Well, then how about love? You talk about logical. Is love logical? Well, people try to make love logical. They do. There's enough science around love. People study it. They say it's as good as chocolate. You know, there's one study that compares being in love to like being under the influence of chocolate because of what it does to the prostaglandins and other parts of your body that seems to respond to both. What would you rather have, love or chocolate? Well, by now, you know, a lot of people choose chocolate. Today, I want to talk about the science of love. Yes, the science of love, what makes it happen. And I'm going to talk about that thing that happens when you hug somebody for a long period of time and you hold them all night and you're, you know, after wonderful lovemaking, massage, touch. What is it all about? Do we think it's just affection? Or is there some chemical mandate, some biological imperative that is being laid out so that you follow according to what your chemistry is demanding you do, and you do it? So we're going to talk about that today. I want to talk about relationships, and I'm going to talk to you about what happens when you form a relationship, what happens when you're in a relationship, what happens when the relationship goes numb, dead, how you keep it alive. But we're going to go along with the whole progression. We're going to start from before you even whisper each other's name. I'm going to take you on this trip of a relationship. Let's start off at the beginning. Before you meet the other person or met the other person, what determines how you're going to respond to a person or not? We've heard enough about that chemistry, but there's a number of things that go on. Like your respective mental states, the state of mind. Let's say you're standing at a subway platform and somebody comes over and says, standing next to you, nowadays we know after yesterday's program, they're standing a little off to the side as opposed to directly in front of you. They're not going to be within 6 inches and 2 feet of your body, but within the respectable 3 feet to 8 feet. And they're looking at you and they say, train's late. Now, this is the beginning. This is the first moment. But before that first moment, before you looked at that other person and said, yeah, he or she's kind of cute. Well, that's kind of interesting. And before you said, train's not late, train's on time, well, we just missed one, or whatever you say. Before all of that takes place, a number of other things have taken place. Before you got to that subway platform, a number of things have happened, like you may have just ended another relationship. So let's say you ended another relationship recently and your mind is there, either willing or unwilling to have a relationship, because if you're in a successful love relationship, you may not be looking for anybody else. Your door may be closed. And if your door is closed, the person can come over knocking, but you don't answer. So what are you feeling? If you're available, that's one thing. We put you now out there on the subway platform and you're available. Or you're not available. But if you are available, another thing, factor that determines what's going to happen on that very first moment is your self-esteem level. How are you feeling about yourself? You know, do you think you're too fat, you're too skinny, you're too old, you're too young, you don't like the way you look, you don't like the way you feel? Is your job not going well? Are you lonely? Is your family not in the same town as you, so you've got nobody to fall back on? You know, are you hungry that day? Are you feeling a little sick? Are you under the weather? Do you have a cold? What is all of this you bring with you to that subway platform? Your physical well-being. Your financial well-being. How are you doing financially? Are you just making ends meet? You know, are you struggling through? Are you about to take finals? You know, and you have a certain mental set, you have a great tension on you from your job. Other things that affect your very response to that person the first minute you meet them is your general trust level. recently you've been betrayed, and you don't trust anybody, especially a man. You don't trust anybody. It's just kind of a feeling. Or recently, someone gypped you out of something, and you're angry, and you don't trust anybody. And recently you heard there's a pickpocket in the neighborhood, and so you don't trust. So your general trust level, your specific trust level. Now, also what affects you, believe it or not, as to whether you're willing to meet somebody and be open to a new relationship is your private living space. What are you coming from? What's your cave like where you are? Do you like where you live? Are you venturing out of a place that you like? Or do you hate the place you live? Do you live with roommates, like a lot of people who live with roommates who are just dying to find somebody who they could spend the night with other than coming home to their roommates? Everything can affect your mental set when you meet someone for the first time, and this includes friends as well as lovers. For example, it could be spring. If it's spring outside, you're going to feel a little friendlier than you do in the winter. You know, because in the winter, there's kind of the doldrums, and you're kind of drawn inside, and you feel a little cave-like or igloo-like. But in the spring, you feel like bursting out, and you're ready for love. You may carry messages around in your head. You could be just filled in your mind with things like your mother saying, when are you going to get married? When are you going to give me a grandchild? When are you going to do this? So you're, you know, you may carry mental things that affect how you're going to respond to the person, or it may be a holiday season. It could be Valentine's Day, Christmas, New Year's, Thanksgiving, and it's a time when you see people with each other. You see people are usually partnered, and it emphasizes your existential aloneness, and you're kind of ready to be with somebody or not according to the way you're feeling. It's always set in a setting, my friends. Set represents your mental set, your emotional set, your spiritual set at the moment. If you're not feeling together or if you are feeling together, it's all going to affect what you do the moment you meet somebody for the first time. All of these influences determine whether it be a friend or a prospective lover, a friend or a prospective lover, how you're going to respond to them. So then what happens? Well, there's the first conversation that you have with somebody, whether it be on a subway platform or it be somewhere outside or you meet somebody just serendipity passing, you know, somebody passing by, somebody talks to you, somebody at the job who you've never spoken to before, a casual conversation, first conversation. I don't know why people celebrate their anniversaries or their weddings. First conversation, very big day. You know, they should have the anniversary of your first conversation. Even if your first conversation is a dating service on the internet that hooks you up with somebody, and your first conversation is an email conversation, it's the first contact. But remember, you're carrying all that stuff behind you. You're carrying all the weight of everything that got you to that spot, all these influences, and so is the other person. You're both carrying huge amounts of information to this spot. So when you meet each other, it's not just do I like her, do I not like her, it's do I like her, how am I feeling about myself, how's my apartment, how's my mother, what's my relationship like, did I end a relationship recently? All of those influences are at force. Today we're going to show you chemical influences on your love relationships that affect the long-term potential. Be sure you stay with us. It's a big deal. So comes this first conversation. First conversation, you know, might be on a telephone. Somebody gives you a phone number. Call up my friend. My friend's got a friend. Right? You get him, and now all you have is their voice. And now you're listening to the voice and what they have to say. Do they sound smart? Do they sound stupid? Do they sound intelligent? Do they have a nice voice? Imagine somebody with a bad voice. Well, maybe you like that bad voice. Maybe it sounds childlike or something like that, and you kind of like it. Or maybe the voice cracks, or maybe it's deep, or maybe it's soft, or maybe you're now going on the voice. You don't have a picture yet. So now the very first conversation is one thing, but comes the first meeting. the first time you see them physically, how do they look? You know, it's not just looks, handsome, not handsome, pretty, not pretty, shapely, not shapely. There's a whole bunch of things that go on in the human body. I mean, our bodies are programmed so that the male responds in females to what's called the hip-to-waist ratio. Yes, would you believe it? Nature, in your DNA, by the way, for all of us who want to celebrate something, you might want to light a candle. It's the 50th anniversary today of the discovery of DNA. 50th. 50 years. Well, talking about DNA, everything. Everybody has a physical preference, but biologically you tend to be attracted to, if it's male, the general attraction, it's to somebody who is rugged, who seems like they're going to be strong, physically strong, and that they're going to carry on some, you have good potential to pass on genes with you. And for the female, it's the hip-to-waist ratio, because that's how good she's going to be at bearing children. That's what nature says. But a lot of people like people who have a minimal hip-to-waist ratio. You know, you could weigh 40 pounds and there's going to be somebody who's going to love you, somebody who's going to find you very attractive. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it's absolute, but there are certain biological things. In that biology is smell. Believe it or not, when you meet somebody for the first time, there is some sense you have of what they smell like. I know you're going to say, oh, no, don't give me anybody smelly. But we have an olfactory sense, a smell sense that's going to pick up on the pheromones of a person, and they don't have to be anywhere near us. We can smell them. There was an experiment that was done where they gave women a bunch of used T-shirts. Men's T-shirts, right? And they said, here, smell these and tell me which ones they like the most. You know what they discovered? They discovered the women were attracted to the T-shirts of men who had an immune system different than their own. Was there a commonality of immune system? No. The people who had the immune system in their DNA that was different than your own DNA attracted you more. Isn't that funny? Because nature wants you to mate with somebody whose immune system is different. Because nature wants you to build your immune system, not repeat it. That's why so often you're not attracted to people who are in your family. You know, you don't feel chemistry with them because their immune system's the same as yours. If not, there would be incest all over the place. Well, you look at this other person and now you've got a smell. You know, how do they dress? Are they very masculine? Are they feminine? Are they gentle? Are they well-dressed? Or are they goth? You know, age matters. Older, younger, clean, rugged, prim or loose, you know? So either you meet the person for the first time, or they send you a photo by email, you know, here I am. The visual says a lot. So this is all leading up to that first meeting, that first encounter. From this, we are going to go to what happens to people 3 years after you meet for the first time when the romance is over. And why? Armand DeMille here with you. Very exciting stuff. So then there's a number of other firsts that you have in a mating with somebody or a meeting with somebody, and this includes friend. You know, includes friend for the first time. You have the first conversation, you know, that goes on. We know that. And then you have the first meeting. You have the first date. Now, the first date is, it was once said that in a one-hour conversation with a person you've never met before, there are thousands of pieces of information that are exchanged. Thousands. Things that you don't even know you're seeing. You're seeing, like, how do they hold their fork? You know, what do they order on the menu? How are they like? How do they deal with other people? How do they talk to other people? You know, how do they talk to that waitress or waiter or wait person or the person at the front door? How about their intelligence? All of this information you're picking up, their voice, are they considerate or are they self-absorbed? You know? everything you learn about a person for the first time, you're evaluating whether you like it or not. First date, great stuff. Definitely should be anniversaries of the first date. First conversation should be anniversary. First date should be an anniversary. In certain traditions, there's speed dating. Speed dating, you know, 20 minutes, sit down at a table, you meet somebody, you talk to them for a few minutes, you get all your information. You get your thousands of pieces in 20 minutes. You get up, you move on to the next person, you move on to the next person, and they do that, and they try to see if they want to hook up in some way. They set it up at a bar or a gathering place where you get a fast, maybe 10 minutes to evaluate. I think it's only 10 minutes. First date. So much happens on that first. The first date, my friends, is a big deal. Now, first date is a big deal, and we're going to come back to first date because, you know, there is a chemical thing about the first date that is very important. You're going to learn that excitement, things that give you excitement, is what makes you go back for more. The body wants to be excited. We're going to explain that to you chemically in just a couple of minutes. But after or during the first date or at the end of a first date or somewhere beyond the first date, there's a first touch. You want an anniversary? The anniversary of the first touch. It could be a big deal, especially it could be a handshake. You shake somebody's hand for the first time, even if it's a prospective friend. Ooh, that feels good. Do you ever shake a limp hand? You know, one that's like a wet noodle? Tells you something, you know? But maybe you're a noodlette, you know? Maybe you like noodles. Maybe you do. I don't know. A touch on the shoulder, a handshake, a hand holding your elbow while you're getting in and out of a car, or something like that. That touch, that first touch. You're aware of it. You don't know you're aware of it. There are microbes going through your skin that are sending out signals and receptors. How do I like this touch? You feel it and you know it, and there's things in your body, just like there are pheromones, there are things that are picking up about that touch. Think about somebody you love. How do you like their touch? How do you feel when they touch you? First touch. First touch, very important. First kiss. Oh, my gosh, another big deal. First kiss is a very big deal. Lips are very sensitive. Lip to lip, celebrate that, you know? Then after that, there's the first sex. After that, there's the first sleepover sex. You know, you want to stay over? You don't stay over, okay. You sleep together. Big deal. The people think this is not much of a deal because it's just sex. Oh, no, it's not. You hold somebody's flesh against your flesh, and you hold on to them. And between your skin while you're asleep, stuff takes place. There are all kinds of things happening in those little sweat droplets that go from place to place. You know when you're in the right place, when somebody is holding you or you're holding somebody, and you know what you feel? You feel perfection. And when you feel perfection, this is a good thing. See? First sleepover, big deal. First go away together, right? You take a night out, you get in a car, you travel somewhere together, you get in a bus. First go away. That's a big deal because now you're out of your safe environments. You don't have all your accoutrements. You don't have all your stuff. You're taking risks. You know what else is a great first in relationships? The first fight. How do you handle the first fight? The first time you're angry at each other, you can't believe it because you're usually, this happens, usually after a first couple of dates, you're loving this person, you're caring about this person, and then all of a sudden you have your first fight. First fight is brutal. You feel like your heart's being ripped in half. Oh, how could I be angry at this person? How you deal with your first fight? Very, very big deal. Big anniversary, you know what I mean? That should be one that everybody celebrates. And then there's the first meeting with friends, the first time you bring this person to meet your friends, right? Oh, that's very important because you're looking around. How do you like them? What do you think? What do you think of her? And then there's the first meeting with the family. First meeting with the family, oof, that's a big deal. The first time you invite them over for dinner at your place, let them see how you cook, you know, if you can. Or, you know, invite them over to dinner and see how well you could do takeout. Either one, it's a skill. Now, in the first year, this is what seems to happen. So now you've got your relationship, and now it's kind of solid. Now, all the stuff in your background kind of went in with all the stuff in your foreground, and there you are. You like the way they look. You like the way they smell. You like the way they taste. You like the way they feel. You like the way they sleep with you. You like all of that stuff. So you decide, let's do it. And you decide to live together, move in together, live, you know, do something, get married, whatever you decide. Now, this goes beyond friendship, or it includes friendship, but you are definitely with this person in the first year of a relationship. We have a part of our brain called the caudate nucleus. You ready for this? Somewhere in your mind is a caudate nucleus, and it is possible that you could image the caudate nucleus, because if you image the caudate nucleus, you could see dopamine being released. In the first love year, dopamine gets triggered in excess, and it creates the kind of energy, the kind of exhilaration, the kind of focused attention. It lights up the caudate nucleus. It lights you up. It energizes you. That's why at the beginning there's so much energy. You can make love all night. At the beginning, you could stay up and watch the sunrise together. You know, where now you look back and you wonder how you could have stayed up an hour after having sex. Back then, it was all night. You had so much energy. Why? You think you drank more coffee back then? No, this is dopamine. I think that's where the word dopamine comes from. You know, it makes a dope of you. You get this dopamine circuit is triggered, and now you're on fire. It makes you feel like taking risks beyond your normal limits. A person in love will ski down a slope that will have a much higher inclination or lower inclination than they normally will. They would do things that they would take risks that they wouldn't normally take, because dopamine is the risk-taking substance. It helps you. It supports you. There's a dopamine exuberance that you feel, and when you're in love, you're filled with it. A woman named Donatelli Marizetti studied the biochemistry of love and the biochemistry of love sickness. Let's talk about love sickness. She studied the difference between love and the obsessive compulsive disorder, because, you know, sometimes love looks like an obsessive compulsive disorder. She talked about a thing called love sickness. She said love sickness is defined as falling in love and thinking about your new partner at least 4 hours a day. You ever been lovesick? Lovesick. Now, it could be returned or it could be not returned. Without it, you know, it goes with it, with love sickness. And this is usually when there's a little angst in it, you know, usually when maybe it's not returned, but you're madly in love with somebody, but you can't get them off your mind. Sleeplessness, digestive disorders, inability to concentrate on anything else. A sense that nothing else matters but love. You are caught in love sickness, which, believe it or not, is a chemical reaction of the brain. Especially when love is not returned. So Marizetti compared serotonin levels of people in love and people with obsessive compulsive disorders, and then she compared both of those to what's considered a normal group, right? A group of people who are neither deeply in love or lovesick and not obsessive compulsive. She compared those, and here's what she found. The people who were in love and the people who had obsessive compulsive disorders had 40% less serotonin than the normal group. Serotonin, this other hormone of the body. We got dopamine, and we have serotonin. Serotonin drops radically in people who are in love and people who are obsessed. A man named Abram Fisher comes along studying this and says the following. He says Prozac, which is given to people with obsessive compulsive disorders, inhibits or raises the serotonin level. Remember, you have low serotonin levels, obsessive compulsive disorders, raise the serotonin level, and people are not so obsessive compulsive. If you know an obsessive compulsive person, they give them Prozac or any of its children, you know, any of the different drugs that are called serotonin reuptake inhibitors, any of those, they give them that and it raises the serotonin. Now, here's the problem. If you give it to a lovesick person, it raises the serotonin, but it dulls the person. In fact, people who are in love, if they're depressed and they are put on Prozac, they lose their ability to stay in love and fall in love during the Prozac time, according to Abram Fisher. By inhibiting the libido, you increase the serotonin. You take away a lot of the grief of obsessive compulsive disorder, but by raising that serotonin level, you make a person go somewhat numb to love. I'm a mental health practitioner. I interview a lot of people. I see a lot of people who are couples in relationships. I interview a lot of couples. I very often hear that somebody, as a quick fix for depression, because there are slow fixes for depression, like psychotherapy, the quick fix to depression is take an anti-depression drug. And most of those drugs prescribed nowadays are the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and they are the Prozacs, et cetera, et cetera. People are given this, and they lose their love. They're no longer connected to their partners. They fall out of love. But they don't really care. They're kind of dull. So very often, you know, I'll be looking at a couple, and the couple will say, what's gone wrong between us? We're so separate. You'll find that Prozac was introduced somewhere in the middle of the relationship. Many people who also take an SSRIs feel a dullness towards their mates, and it also dulls the libido. When you feel dull towards your mate and you raise your serotonin, you just don't feel so sexually excited. Thomas Lewis, a psychiatrist, believes that there are many influences on whether a person is going to stay in love with their partners, as well as whether or not you give them these SSRIs, these drugs. I mean, Thomas Lewis said, however your relationship was with your mother when you were a baby, if you were comfortable at the breast, if you were able to suckle at the breast then, and you did that comfortably, and your mom was comfortable breastfeeding you, then you have greater potential, man or woman, greater potential to be close to another human. We're going to talk about that because we're going to talk about the role of bonding when we get back from our break. So it seems real simple. Natural feeding of the breast seems to make an infant more capable to grow up to become an adult who has a good, close, bonded, passionate relationship. What do you think being bottle fed does to you? You think it creates alcoholics? I don't know. It's just kidding. Maybe. Hey, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll play you a little music about attraction. When we come back, we're going to talk about what happens after the first 3 years and what you could do about it if you don't like the way it looks. We'll be back.
Non-commercial radio. WBAI 99.5 FM.
99.5.
Now we gotta do it all from the top again.
Just say 99.5.
99.5
FM.
In New York City.
I wanna do it. Okay, Armand, bring it in.
Yes.
copycat dolls, my friend. Can't help it, but they absolutely have the information for us. We went as far as we felt like going. Well, there's an important statement for you. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 and FM. Giving you information about things. Information about love. We went as far as we felt like going. What does that mean? What does it mean when you feel like you love somebody? You feel like you want to climb their bones. You feel passionate. You know what I mean? I mean, when does that kiss lose its excitement? So we've been talking about what happens in relationships from the very beginning to when you finally hook up. And if you just tuned in, you can get a copy of today's program by going on the internet and seeing our website, thepositivemind.com, or going to WBAI's website, which I hear has been having some trouble uploading these programs, but you'll find it on thepositivemind.com. And if you have no other way, you can call my office and we'll get you a copy somewhere at 212-757-4488. Now, let's go back to this thing about what happens in love, right? It's an amazing thing. If on your first date, right, the thing we're looking for is dopamine. We want dopamine to be increased. If on the very first date you have with somebody, it's an exciting event, the person is three times as likely to come back for a second date because the caudate nucleus likes to record lots of dopamine. It likes to see excitement. You don't want to be flat on your first date. People who are really sharp at this and speed dating, they could sit in a chair in 10 minutes and they could tell you whether or not you've increased their dopamine. They don't know that's what they're doing, but if we had a camera to photograph the caudate nucleus, we would see when they sit down with you, either it's being attracted or not attracted based on the amount of activity you're seeing. You know, so what I would do is I'd go around and I'd teach to people about their caudate nucleus, see what you can do to get the caudate nucleus going. Well, the thing that gets it going is excitement. You are three times more likely to have a second date with somebody if on the first date you do something thrilling, like, you may not like the idea, but going on a roller coaster or sharing a movie that's exciting, like a horror movie. Why do people do it? Well, they do it because they get excited. It turns them on. It gets that dopamine going, and it associates you with the excitement. So the worst kind of date is a flat date. You know, let's go eat some shumai and we'll listen to music on our respective iPods. This is not going to work as well. What you want to do is get excitement going, and excitement is a very important thing. And I'm not saying that you cannot be spiritual. You could be deeply spiritual. But if I took Buddhist number one with Buddhist number two and put them together and they had a meal together and we looked at their caudate nucleus, we'd see a lot of dopamine because they could excite each other. Because just because they meditated does not mean that they don't have this excitement. That's if you're a Buddhist that dates. There are a lot of Buddhists that date. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a culture. Now, what happens? You get this dopamine-drenched state of romantic love. It's fantastic. It's incredible. It's exciting. Can't look forward to the next time. And now what happens after 3 years? This dopamine state of romantic love starts to yield to another hormone, which is oxytocin. Now, oxytocin is very important because oxytocin is the bonding material, you see? This is the bonding hormone. This is the one that makes you feel connected. So at first you got the dopamine, which makes you feel excited. But now comes the oxytocin. Oxytocin is the hormone that promotes the feeling of connection, the feeling of bonding. It's released when mothers, for example, nurse their infants. When mothers nurse their infants, both the infant and the mother, loads of oxytocin, right? It's an oxytocin state of mind, low dopamine. We don't want too much excitement, but we do want high oxytocin. When we hug our long-term mates, when you hold them, you stay close to them, it's that first overnight. This is the beginning of the oxytocin. Prospective fathers, by the way, prospective fathers, meaning the baby's about to be born, they have increased oxytocin before the baby's born so that they could bond better. Prairie voles. That's such a word, prairie voles. Sounds like somebody's name, doesn't it? I'd like you to meet prairie vole. A prairie vole is a kind of rodent. You know, rodents have bad names, but it's a kind of a rat-like thing. Now, these on the prairie, they have very high levels of oxytocin. Very high levels of oxytocin, and they mate for life. They meet a prairie vole meets, you know, Joanna prairie vole meets Tony prairie vole. Two of them get together, that's it. Solid. Mate for life, loaded with oxytocin. Scientists have picked up some prairie voles, and they block the receptors by giving them a chemical. They block the oxytocin receptors in these rodents, and then they put them back out there, and they find out the rodent stops being monogamous, it doesn't bond, and it tends to wander. So oxytocin is very important for monogamy, and oxytocin blocking could cause a wandering eye, but we're going to see what blocks it. Some researchers believe that autism is a deficiency in oxytocin, and if you think about it, if you think about the autistic child, they do not bond. You know, it makes all the sense in the world, and some of the way that they're treating autism is with oxytocin. See, and it seems to be effective. Now, back to Helen Fisher. Helen says that you can massage, hug, make love. And when you massage, hug, make love, and have orgasms, or have orgasms, or throw a few orgasms in just for the hell of it, oxytocin increases. So this is it. Touch, massage, hugging, making love. Right? Orgasm. All of that increases oxytocin. Now we got dopamine, which is very exciting, right? You have that. Now you add the oxytocin, you know, which includes sexual orgasm and stuff. So you have the passion of the dopamine, the excitement, the fire, you know. Gotta be with you. And then you have the oxytocin love feeling triggered. And now, boom. You have real stuff. You have a relationship that feels fabulous. And what happens? At the same time, serotonin is lowered. It lowers the serotonin. You have high dopamine, you have high oxytocin, you have a perfect state of relationship, and you have lower serotonin. You're in a good mood. You're in a good mood. You are loved. You feel loved. You feel loving. You have romantic and passionate love. However, after a few years, something takes the dopamine away. And the trouble is, dopamine seems to need excitement. That's why we talked about the roller coaster. You know, you talk about a roller coaster on the first date or going to horror movies or any of the scary stuff that happens or taking risks. Dopamine, important. It kind of keeps you interested. It keeps you connected. So what happens after the first 3 years is dopamine gets reduced with familiarity, and then comes this thing where you find between couples where they're no longer having sex, but they're just holding each other. And it's a new thing. You know, it's a thing where you say, well, I don't really feel like having sex, but I really love you, and I want to hold you, and I stay close to you. And so you have now an oxytocin-based closeness, which is everything but the dopamine in it. And you could get by on it. You can get by that way. And oxytocin love, kind of love, can last forever. It's just something feels like it's missing. And you got to watch out for midlife crisis. Because somewhere around menopause for men and women, you know, where men go through this kind of menopausal thing too, where they start feeling it, as they start to die away a little, as you lose your last eggs, you know, as you feel like, you know, you're not going to be reproducing anymore, something inside you comes up and says, give me dopamine, that'll keep us alive. So very often people who are going through menopause, or what I call midlife crisis in men, which is a kind of a male menopause in my mind, what they go for is they go for excitement. Give me something that'll excite me. I'll go buy a new Jaguar. Men do. They want to feel excitement. Feed them their Jaguars. Let them get excited. But what happens is if you don't find it, of course, you're going to look for excitement somewhere else. For that phase of your life, you're going to look for excitement. And when you don't find it or when you give up on it, you kind of let that part of you die. And you're back to an oxytocin kind of love life. Now, if in the middle of it you get depressed, which very often people do, you know, like midlife depression, you get that, then they give you Prozac. Now look what happens. Now you're really sending that dopamine out the window. Now you're saying, bye-bye, dopamine. I don't think I'll be seeing you back anymore. And the dopamine goes away and your excitement goes. And now you have an oxytocin kind of romantic feeling towards your partner, but you don't really feel like hugging because the serotonin gets lowered. And the hugging doesn't feel essential because you're on your own. And you feel alone. And so, it follows this path. Now, normally, what would happen about this time in life, many for the generations, is people would start to die. You know, this is around 60 years old, time to go out on the ice, and, you know, just kind of let your life fade away. But no, they don't do it anymore. We've challenged life, now we're living much older, so what's the answer, my friends? The answer is keep the excitement in your life. Here's what not to do. Do not take vacations in familiar places. Don't get a home that you go to over and over again in the Hamptons or somewhere and just keep repeating to the same place and do it every year with no variation. It's not a way of getting dopamine going. Take a trip somewhere. Go to Morocco. Go to Kenya. Go to some place where you could feel excitement. Go to Israel and just look down at the gates and say, wow. Feel that aliveness in your bones, and you're going to find it carries right through to your bed as well. Excitement becomes very important. The tendency is to move towards security, and so many people do that. They feel this oxytocin kind of safety with their mates, and they kind of move towards, well, let's get a house, and let's have some kids, and now everything's secure, and you get more and more secure, and you repeat your vacations in the same place over and over again. You go to this Caribbean spot, place in the Caribbean, oh, let's go to St. John's and we'll stay at this place. And you stayed in the same place, but it's the same, and it's the same, and it's the same, and there's no excitement. And without excitement, you have no passion. So now what you have is a passionless vacation, which people are used to. When they come back, and they usually feel stressed out. So you're going to lift up the dopamine, and you want to get, you want to especially get the dopamine lifted around the third year. Because that's when you start to lose the dopamine in place of oxytocin. You get the oxytocin, you want to keep the dopamine. So here's all of this. May sound like a chemistry lesson, you know, in place of discussion on love and human relations. I've heard people strongly object to the reduction of human passions and preferences to biological imperatives based on genetic structures. I understand. I understand. We want love to be love. Who needs to have a science of love? We want sex to be sex. Who wants to? People, when they taste something like ice cream, tea, pasta sauce, they like it just to be what it is, a pasta sauce. I like to taste the flavors. I love to taste all the separate flavors, and then I like the umami. You know, umami, we talked about umami. Umami is that taste bud, that thing we have that helps taste everything go together. You know, it's our sense of what goes together. Well, I like knowing what goes inside things. Here we live in a world where people will read the ingredients on a package, but they don't want to know the ingredients of love. They don't want to know the ingredients of passion. Well, why not? Why not find out how much chemistry is going on? Why not understand yourself on every level possible? Here's what I think. The more you understand, the better you can love. The less you understand, the more judgmental you'll be, both of yourself and other people. Like, isn't it a relief to know that when a woman becomes pregnant, her smell, her olfactory sense, turns away from her husband, where she no longer finds him attractive, and she feels herself drawn to her family? This is during pregnancy and shortly thereafter. Nature did it that way. It wants you not to complicate things. So for the time being, the very smell of your husband's T-shirt is a bad thing. Just nature. Now, if you're that husband, do you feel rejected? If you're that husband who doesn't understand, do you resent the child that's being born? If you'd say you have a son, and suddenly your wife doesn't want to go near you anymore, do you get angry at your son? Do you wind up with a resentment? Do you wind up for the rest of your life trying to put that kid down because that your wife turned against you when the child was born? Not if you understand it, you see. So if you understand, okay, now here she is. She's not going to feel particularly attracted to me right now. I'm not going to take that as a great offense. We'll make love anyway. And I'm going to love my child. Because it's natural for her to turn away from me. Yes, she wants to spend more time with her family. That's fine. Because it's natural for her to do that. See, the more we know, the easier it is for us. And the easier it is for the people we love. Isn't it wonderful if you were listening to the program I did recently with Roberta Atti, where you understand that if you're standing in an elevator and somebody walks in, if you're a man and somebody walks in and they look you in the eye, all this chemistry goes on inside of you to prepare you for a challenge. Isn't that great? You can laugh at yourself. I laugh at myself all the time watching my automatic reactions inside. I think it's so funny because I'm silly sometimes, and sometimes I'm just like a biological mess. Here I am reacting just like a silverback gorilla. You know? So, friends, I think our chemistry lessons are really good. They're really good because they're going to bring your heart even closer and closer to people. They're going to help you embrace more people. That's the object. That's the idea. So now, my friends, here's an opportunity for you. You know, anthropologists used to think that romance was a Western construct, a bourgeois byproduct of the Middle Ages. Romance, a lot of people thought, for the scientists, they thought was for the middle class. They were for people who sat at cafes, people on silk sheets or in rooms with flickering fires. They thought it was just all some kind of a Western idea, and that people who were peasants who couldn't afford much, they never got involved in love or romance. It was purely, you know, one of those things that Shakespeare created. You know, it turns out that scientists now believe that romance is pan-human. Embedded in our brains since the Pleistocene times, in a study of 166 cultures, anthropologist William Jankowitz observed evidence of passionate love in 147 of them. In another study, men and women from Europe, Japan, and the Philippines were asked to fill out a survey to measure their experience of passionate love, and all three groups professed feeling passion with the same searing intensity. Think about the searing intensity of love and passion. Think about that. Think about your own experience with it. You must have felt it at some time in your life. It's a beautiful thing. And that kind of sets down the template, you know, that kind of gives you an idea of what we're doing here on the planet, meaning that we're not on the planet to love people. That's not the idea. But we're on this planet and we're given this assistance, and the assistance is the ability to love. It's our best tool. So if you feel angry at those folks out there who may not be doing it right, my friends, well, understand. Understand that some people are so wounded, they just can't do it. They can't go to it. They're afraid to. Understand that some people are so wounded that all they can do is intellectualize, you know, and they can't really let themselves feel it. Understand that. But you could do it. You could let yourself do it. And here's what I suggest. I suggest you let yourself reminisce. Reminisce, think back about the loves you've had in your life. And don't be afraid of them. Don't be afraid to think back of the love you felt that caused you pain. Don't be afraid of it. Shed a tear. You know? Bring it back into your life. Bring that good stuff back. Let yourself feel it. Because no matter how old you are, you've still got that little oxytocin bonding material. And with a little activity here, we can get that dopamine working. A little novelty, maybe. So use this time. Use the rest of our time today to just kind of sit back. Reminisce. Think about love. Hey, I'll be back with you soon. Be sure to send me an email. Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, at brainlink.com. Or if you want to look at the website, it's thepositivemind.com. Back with you soon, my friends.